Please help me welcome our speaker tonight, Billy N. from Wall, New Jersey.
Hi, I'm Billy, I'm an alcoholic. And my sobriety date is January 5th, 1990. My home group is the Design for Living Big Book Study Group in Wall, New Jersey. And I want to welcome anyone here that's new. I always try to say, there's a group of people that I really identify with in AA, and those are people that hate AA and don't believe in God. Like, that is my group of people. Because I try to remind them all the time that, you know, we have one requirement to be here. And like in AA, and believing in God is definitely not one of them. I know most of the people that I hang out with were in one of those two categories or both for a good amount of time until they were able to have a spiritual experience as a result of the 12 steps. But I also know that you can't schedule a spiritual experience. There are some people out there I know who, even from podiums like this, want to convince people that you can schedule a spiritual experience. Or that, you know, I try to stay away from words like "you should," or telling people what they need to do, and try to stick to what I did. I've found that over the last 19 years, when it comes to what I did, the thing that is most useful with the people that I work with are not my successes or my victories, but my out-and-out failures. I find that my failures, if I'm willing to be humble, are the thing that really let people know it's okay to trust. When I come from a position of being on some moral hilltop, like the Big Book and Working with Others talks about, I repel people. I push people away. I expect them to live to a standard that even I don't live to. And, you know, at one time, and I want to wish everyone, whatever holiday you celebrate, you know, I hope it's a great one and a happy new year. And we just passed Thanksgiving, and there was probably a time when I was so rigid a Big Book thumper that I would get to a podium and tell other people whose lives I have know nothing about. I know none of the crosses that they may be bearing in their life. I don't know any of their daily struggles or problems, but yet be arrogant enough to tell them that the holidays are no different than the rest of the year. Every day is a day, no matter what. Well, now that I've been sober 19 years, out of custody 18 years, allowed back at my family's holiday celebrations for 17 years, I have a lot more personal experience about this time of year. And that is that although I stay sober a day at a time, and although I still go to the same meetings, and I still have the same sponsor during the holiday season, there are some things in my life that I just can't avoid that change. Number one, I'm around my family a lot more than I usually am. Now, I can't speak for other people. I only have my story. My family and healthy, although it didn't make me an alcoholic, are definitely not two words that most people would use together for a long time. I also know that I'm around places that alcohol is much more than I ever am, because during the year, unless I'm at a Yankee game or a concert or maybe out to work with people at work, I'm not around alcohol a lot. You know, most of my friends are sober. I have a good many friends who aren't. But around the holiday season, I find myself surrounded by alcohol. I wind up going out to lunch a lot more at work. I wind up going out to dinner a lot more. I wind up getting invited to a lot more holiday parties. And I do the same thing today that I was taught to do like 18 years ago when I first got out of jail. And, you know, I want to share for the newcomer, I'm glad I still do those things. And not because my life is like perfect. Because I want to tell you about my last Thanksgiving. You know, I was taught to do a lot of things when I go home for the holidays. And whatever home may be, whether it's your parents' house, traveling another state, going to a relative's house that you're not usually at, but I was taught a lot of things that are practical sobriety tips that are mandatory. Like, there's no room for discussion. And those are, number one, I don't go anywhere without a plan. And number two, if I'm traveling to a place I don't live in, I call that intergroup or central office a week or two before I go there. And I have that number in my phone or in my pocket, if I date myself back to pre-cell phone. You know, and I have a phone list. And I also try to call that place before I go there. And I try to talk to somebody and get their name so that I don't feel uncomfortable if I have to call. Because, and the other thing, which maybe, you know, my financial status has changed a little. I'm not rich by any means, but I don't live in a welfare hotel anymore. And I'm not homeless, so I don't want to deny that. But I was also taught that I don't go anywhere where I can't get out of there on my own dime. Like, my family has the best of intentions, but they're like me. I have a lot of great intentions when I'm sober. It's great intentions. But once they start drinking, the same person who told me that I pleaded with, listen, if I give the signal, I need to leave. If that person is drinking or around my crazy family, they somehow don't have the same answer. They start saying things like, I gotta leave now. You're kidding me, right now? This is the best part of the night. Like, I need to have my own plan. And if that means that I can't go because I don't have cab fare, or I don't have bus fare, or I don't have train fare, then I don't go. It's just not safe. And maybe once I've been through the 12 steps, and not even once, a couple of times, do I get the 10-step promises in my life where I'm safe and protected, and I feel neutral around alcohol and I recoil it? Maybe yes. But I would be absolutely spiritually arrogant to tell anyone that's new that they're in that same self, safe and protected world. And I want to tell you, last Thanksgiving, if you're new, I want to share my experience because it's recent. I was 18 years sober last Thanksgiving. I went to my brother's house in California. I called the Northern San Diego Intergroup about a week before I went out. I went online and I printed out the meeting list. And I had it in my pocket, in my one of the bags I was carrying. Thanksgiving morning, I went to a meeting. Thanksgiving night, I went to dinner at my brother's house. My parents are both deceased, but all my siblings were there. And they were drinking, and we made it through Thanksgiving night. The next day, we went to SeaWorld, spent the whole day again with the family, and then we made a horrible decision. We decided that maybe we could have dinner two nights in a row. That perhaps last night went so well, we could have another night of that. And, let me report what happened. People were drinking a little, not like I drink, but enough to lose control of their mouth. And the election came up, and I had went to the bathroom, and I'm not exaggerating one bit. When I left that bathroom, it was like I was transported 28 years back into my past. Because I left the bathroom of my brother's house, and I walked into the kitchen of my parents' house. Because when I got out of there, children were screaming. My sister was crying. My one brother was yelling at my other brother with words I won't use from an AA podium, that he was acting just like our dad. That brother was kicking my other brother out of his house. Children that probably should have been to bed hours ago had no business still being up and were in various stages of undress, were on people's shoulders or being pulled up to get out of the house quickly. And that was my 18th year Thanksgiving the day after. And I'm glad that I had my own rented car. I'm glad that I had somebody's phone number if I wanted to call them. I'm glad that I knew the next morning where I would be going to a morning meeting. And I also left there the only sibling talking to all the other siblings, which is amazing. Because I was a black sheep of the family. And so I think, sometimes, and I can only talk about myself, we get sober, we stay sober, we get active. Maybe we've been through the book a few times. Maybe we've taken a few people through the book. And I want to act like I'm bulletproof. And I don't want to tell newcomers. It's like I was taught about dating newcomers. My old sponsor would say, if you can picture that girl with tubes coming out of her arms, an intubation tube out of her mouth, a doctor with heart paddles right to her right, and you still want to do that, well, then we have a lot to talk about. Because that person, that's the condition they're in. A newcomer who arrives in AA, no matter how good they look coming in the door, they are on death's door. They're basically just arrived in a trauma center. And I don't want to ever be arrogant enough to think that a newcomer has all the protection that some of us who've been through the steps have. And that doesn't make us bulletproof either. I also want to say I saw someone with a Boston Red Sox hat on, so I don't want to, nothing against Boston. However, I got to go to the sixth game of the Yankees World Series this year and watch them win. And I know there's probably some Phillies fans here. I understand that. But I say it because if you're new, let me just bring you back 18 years in my life. I thought my life was over. I thought I'd never go to another Yankee game. I thought I'd never go to see Metallica again. I'd never go to another Monsters of Rock concert. I couldn't understand what I would do with all this time I had on my hands. I seemed to have an incessant amount of time, and time, free time and me have never been a close friend. It's always been the devil's playground for me. Any unused time, I don't come up with constructive things to do with. So when I was, 24 years old on a Friday night in New York City, leaving a meeting, I didn't know what people did at 11 o'clock on a Friday night. So I'd go to the midnight meeting. And then I would go out for coffee after that meeting, and I didn't know what people did at 1:30 in the morning. So I went to the 2 a.m. meeting at Midnight Madness. And then some nights I'd stay up drinking all night in a diner with other kids. And then I would go to the 6 a.m. first things first meeting, which until today, I've tried a lot of things, still at 19 years, I've not become a morning person. I hear all these sober people talk about becoming morning people and enjoying the morning and enjoying getting up early. That's still not happened to me. I keep waiting for it to happen. I still have a problem getting up, and I've still tried everything except going to bed early to do it. I've tried every single remedy except going to bed early. But still to this date, I've never been to that 6 a.m. meeting unless it was in from the night before, still up. I've never gone to that meeting first thing in the morning. But if you are new, what I used to think about is, what do I do with this time? And now I think about my life today and I wonder, the way I drink, where would I find the time? I'd like 2 extra hours in the day just in my life as it is, not drinking. I can't even imagine where I would find the time to drink the way I like to drink. I'm not one of those speakers who's going to say, I'm not going to tell you my drunk log, because if you're new, if you're like me, I know that unless I know you have my problem, I'm not interested in your solution. End of subject. You can tell me you have all the symptoms of an alcoholic. You can tell me you're an emotional alcoholic. You can tell me whatever you want. If you did not, and I don't mean drink exactly like me, but drink, then I don't identify with you. And, I came to AA at 15 years old. I haven't been sober since I've been 15. I came to AA at 15. For 8 years, I was in and out until I was 23. So I only have my story. And my story is that of a teenage alcoholic, for sure. And my story is that I only have one spiritual truth that I can share, and it's my story. But I found out that as much as we're tempted to want to glorify our stories, as much as we're tempted to want to get into one-upmanship, the more honest I am, the more times, even if it's not that night, somebody will call me a couple of months later and say, you said something that night. Because the other thing I said about the holidays that I want to, before I just talk about drinking, is the other thing I know about myself that I learned after 19 years is that no matter how healthy we get, there is something inside me. I don't know what it is. I know the big book tells me there's God inside me, but there's something else inside me. It's like a magnet for bad people. It's a magnet that somehow even people who know nothing about my history, I can be in Yankee Stadium, I can be in Madison Square Garden, I can be anywhere, and the person that I should least likely ever spend any time with somehow crosses my path. And, if you're new, you have to be very careful of that. It's not a joke. I have a good friend of mine who was in the back of a clubhouse when he was 11 days sober, and someone told him if he felt like drinking or using to tell someone else. So he told the guy playing pinball, and the guy playing pinball said, I just got paid. Let's get out of here. So, you have to be very, very careful about who you surround yourself with and who are you trusting to keep you safe and protected. Because I know myself, and I'll just share this story. I'm not afraid. I was at a black tie event at the Waldorf Astoria for work about 4 years ago, maybe 5 years ago now. And there was a woman there. And, you know, I just said to myself, you know, I'm going to find a woman that, you know, I would never go for. You know, I'm going to find, like, you know, somebody who's completely opposite of me, blah, blah, blah. You know how your head talks to you. And so that night, I was at this black tie affair, and everyone looks very, you know, well put together, and they don't look like the people I hang out with usually. And I saw this woman who I know from my industry, and I know she went to an Ivy League school. I know she comes from a really good family. I know she went to, you know, she has the right job at the right place, and exactly who I would never talk to. So I decided maybe I should talk to her. And so about an hour later, leaving that cocktail party, she says, "Let's go to dinner downtown." And I said, "Sure." We were on the cab line. Now, this is the cab line at like 8:30 at night on a weekday in a tux, waiting behind maybe 10 or 12 people in front of us. And she says to me, "I got a ton of coke and ecstasy." And I'm like, you know, I had to excuse myself, and I did. And, you know, I called the guy. And, you know, sometimes we talk about how important it is to have a sponsor, how important it is to have sponsees. But I've found it's just as important to have peers, people on an equal footing, people on an equal level. You know, and I had a good laugh with my friend, and I just said, you know, what has happened to me? I just left this really good-looking woman who has a ton of coke and ecstasy. And I'm walking to the subway, and she's in a cab. And but I say that because you never know. You know, I believe in a lower power as much as a higher power. That's just my belief. And sometimes that lower power will appear, as the big book says, it describes something called suddenly. I don't know when suddenly is going to happen. Suddenly comes in all versions. Suddenly can just appear out of nowhere. Because I was a person who blamed my alcoholism on some outside issue. That something else, some external problem, caused my internal condition. And, you know, one of my favorite lines in the big book is, it was the end of a perfect day, not a cloud on the horizon. Because that's when that gentleman picks up his drink. At the end of a perfect day. No clouds on the horizon. And I, you know, I try to tell new people, you know, these kind of sheets, sometimes treatment centers have a sheet like this, you know, it's laminated or fold it up that they give to people when they leave, and it says everything not to do. Don't hang out in your old places. Don't hang out with your old friends. Don't go to bars. But I've never found one that says whatever you do, don't have a perfect day. You know, I've yet to find one that says at all costs, make sure there's always a cloud on the horizon. And so I know that none of that causes my alcoholism. And, you know, as a 13-year-old boy, I come from a crazy, out of control family. That's just the truth. It doesn't make me an alcoholic. I don't blame my family. But I can't deny where I come from. I come from insanity. And, you know, my life as a 13-year-old boy was all about being away from the family at all costs. Sometimes sports, sometimes staying over at a friend's house so I wouldn't have to be at my house. Sometimes Boy Scouts. Anything to not be home. And none of that worked. And at 13 years old, I got introduced to an 8-pack of Miller. That's my story, you know. An 8-pack of the Miller small bottles. And that night, I had another 8-pack. And as I was listening to Sabbath or Floyd or Molly Hatchet or whoever it would have been at the time, you know, I got hammered. And that's all I know about drinking, is about getting hammered. I don't know any in the middle. I don't know anything about social drinking. I've never done it in my life. I might have a lot of war stories, but they all have one thing in common, which is what I can never forget, the second drink. It's the most important thing that I need to remember. I have never not had a second drink. Sure, there are some nights I didn't drink as much as the last time, but I've never just had one drink. And that night, although I didn't realize it that night, I had probably one of the most important spiritual experiences of my life because, you know, I've realized in sobriety, you know, even maybe at 5 years sober, waking up one day, dreading to do another fourth step about all my behavior in AA, looking in the mirror and saying, like, thank God I don't drink. I never realized how many other problems I really have. I can't even imagine if all these problems right now were multiplied by me drinking, which is just a recipe for insanity. But, you know, when you're new, you know, you come here because your palate's over alcohol and you can't live with it. But then whether it takes you 3 days, 3 months, or 3 years, you reach a point, I reached a point, where I realized I can't live without it either. Like, there's something wrong with me. I can't live with it, but yet I can't function without it. And at age 13, I finally found the missing ingredient, because I had that hole in my stomach, whatever you want to call it. You know, and I always say that, you know, my drinking story is very easy to tell. You know, at age 13, my parents kind of liked me. My siblings liked me. My teachers liked me. My Boy Scout leader liked me. My coaches liked me. But I hated myself. But once I started drinking, it might have taken a couple of months, but all of a sudden, my parents did not like me. My siblings did not like me. My teachers did not like me. My Boy Scout leaders did not like me. My coaches did not like me. But for the first time in my life, I liked myself. Now, I don't know what other people's stories are. I don't know. It's not mine to judge. But I know this. When I see a 13-year-old today, I know how young that is. I realize how young it is. But I also know that it was 13 years too long for me to feel that way. Like, maybe other people think it's not a long time. My story is it was long enough. Once I found another way to live and feel comfortable in my own skin, I was not willing to trade it all back. Consequences have never kept me sober, ever. I run into people, I always say that if I had my own country, my special forces would be filled with alcoholics. Because yes, I've been to funerals and wakes, and I've lost some really good friends. But I also know some other people, and like, they're indestructible physically. Like, they don't die. They just keep drinking. And the consequences keep mounting up. And the physical and the emotional and the spiritual damage gets worse and worse. But they keep going back for more. And that's why I know that my life getting better, even a little bit at a time, is what kept me sober. You know, I heard somebody say the other night, and I had a big resentment when I left the meeting, which is par for the course, you know. If you're new to AA and you've left here with resentments, you've already done something to fit in. You know? It happens to all of us. It just comes with the territory. But somebody had said that they saw a clear sign of God's presence because their nephew didn't go to jail. Now, for a guy who didn't believe in God for a long time, does that mean that because I went to prison that God doesn't like me? For me, the greatest miracle in my life is that a judge finally had enough of me. And, you know, there's a country song out there. I'm not a big country music fan, but there's a country song out there that says, sometimes God's greatest gift is an unanswered prayer. And that song hits me over the head, because most of the real miracles in my life are not the ones where I noticed it right away. Those are just my selfish, totally selfish wants, that I got something immediately, which is the story of my life. The real miracles in my life are things that happened that at the time I thought were the worst. And as I've looked back on my life, I realized, boy, that was a miracle. That judge who told me, you know what, I've had enough of you. You violated 3 probations in my courtroom. You make promise after promise. You bring all these notes signed by people that you go to meetings. You have all these letters. You're full of it. And it's not going to work this time. And I believe that was as much a miracle in my life as maybe someone else who a judge spares from going away. You know, and at 13 years old, you know, I told you my kind of drinking is just, I don't like the word progression, only because I believe if you are an alcoholic, you are an alcoholic. You know, my progression might be social, downward spiral, the type of people I hang out with, the places I go, the things I do. But as far as progression of alcoholism, as far as suffering from the malady that's described in the doctor's opinion and more about alcoholism, I was an alcoholic the first time I walked into AA, as I am today. There's no doubt about it. My progression was that by the time I was in like 10th grade, All I could care about on a Monday morning is, what are we doing on Friday night? And by the time I was in 11th grade, all I could think about on a Monday morning is, I can't make it to Friday night. Like, other kids seem to be able to do it. That's not in the cards for me. And by the time I was in 12th grade, I was a daily drinker, and I rarely was in school on a Monday morning. So that's my progression. And, you know, I've been a blackout drinker since the word go. You know, I love Sandy B when he says that he's one of those people who the doctor should have taken him from the delivery room to the detox. Like, I wish that happened to me, you know? You know, I wish that, you know, somebody would have said, you know, Mrs. Noonan, there's a problem with your son. We have another place in the hospital that can deal with him. I would have, my life, you know, that's where I belonged at that age. But, you know, I'm a person who all I need basically is to wake up at 4 o'clock in the afternoon from the night before, however horrendous the consequences of the night before. I just need to be able to make it to 7-Eleven to get a big gulp and get a new pack of cigarettes and to get messed up as soon as possible again. Like, that is the existence that I lived for a long, long time. And the only painful part of that existence is from waking up until I get drunk again. You know, that being drunk became a normal state for my body. And it took me a long time to learn that that's why I suffer from alcoholism. That being drunk is abnormal to other people, but not to me. Being sober is completely abnormal to my DNA. Completely. And I tell people all the time, you know, when they get mad or they get a little bothered by the steps and the traditions, and they see God and amends, you know, of all the men that I've worked with in Alcoholics Anonymous, I have not met one who tells me that those 12 principles, they just fit into their life like a glove. Like, it's exactly what they were looking for. You know, like, 6 months ago, they went to a little therapy, then went to yoga, been going to the gym, and they just figured that AA would be the next thing to, like, help them along. Those are not the people that I meet. You know, I don't want to, I have another home group because I work in New York City and stay in there a lot, and that's the NYU group, which is right on the border of the East and West Village. And, you know, those are not the people I meet. I meet people where this is the last house on the block. Every bridge has been burned. There's nowhere else to turn. And you wind up here. And, you know, I was told a long time ago that, you know, there's a big difference between life-changing and life-saving. Do you need to change once you get here? Yes. But this is a life-saving program. You know, and I was told a long time ago, you know, that I hear sometimes AA described as a self-help program, you know. I was taught two things about that that have remained in my head from an old, old, angry, I thought he was angry. But he used to say all the time, this is a help the other guy or gal program, not a self-help program. And he used to say all the time, in all those other places, they want you to be hard on your family and easy on yourself. Welcome to AA. We want you to give everyone else a pass and be hardest on yourself. That was a wake-up call for me. A real wake-up call. I always say that Alcoholics Anonymous is the first thing or person that I ever respected in my whole life. Which is a pretty sad statement for a 24-year-old boy to admit that basically I've had disrespect and disdain for everything. And then finally, AA was the first thing I showed respect for. Now, coming to AA as a teenager, you know, I'm sure there's some people here who came in, you know. I really don't think it's any different. I think if you are an alcoholic, AA is AA. Who wants to come here? I don't care if you're 13 or 73. This is just not what we kind of laid out for us in the cards. If you come from my family doesn't believe in alcoholism. They just don't. They have a lot of other words and code words they'll use, but not alcoholic. Because to describe a lot of people's symptoms as alcoholism would be to be painting a pretty bad picture across a lot of people. So they don't use that word. And so, you know, at 13 years old, and then 15 coming in here, you know, we have this thing where, you know, I was taught that AA is for the quitters. It's the traitors team. And, you know, I really didn't like being here. But, you know, I want to say that I hear all these horror stories about people who told people they spilled more than they drank. I never ran into any of those people. I actually ran into some people. The people who bothered me are the people who, once you get a year or two sober and you're in your teens or your 20s and you speak at a meeting and someone comes up to you and says, "You're so lucky to get sober young." And again, it's like one of those miracles. It doesn't feel lucky when you get here at 15. It kind of feels like you've accomplished something that it takes most of the other people you're meeting about 30 more years to do, to get into AA. So I always tell the young guys that I sponsor, don't listen to any of that crap. Your life was going so good, you made it to AA at 17. That is not a good sign. That is not, you know, what, you know, you find other people in the high school yearbook are putting on their wish list. So stay away from those debates. And, you know, when I got here, I was angry. I was here at, suggestion wasn't the word, the order of the family court in New York. I was still a juvenile. And, you know, I came here wearing Levi's and engineer boots and some heavy metal black concert t-shirt and a dungaree jacket with an Ozzy Oil painting on the back of it and a bad, bad attitude. And if you wanted to find me when the preamble was being read, then you better go outside and go to where everyone's smoking while the meeting started already, because that's where you would find me. And I had no respect for anything. And when I came inside, I couldn't be quiet and just find a chair. I would need to come inside and high five or shake hands or, you know, do something to disrupt all the people that were there on time for the meeting. But I'm grateful, you know, sometimes as a big book thumper, you know, I would, years back, I might get on a little bit of a tirade about don't listen to the slogans and all that other stuff. You know what? I love the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I still love going through the steps. And I don't go through the steps to make myself a perfect person. I go through the steps to become a better channel of carrying the message. End of subject. I am never going to be a perfect person. At best, I am weak, frail, and prone to do things that shame me. That's what my first sponsor taught me. At best. I worked the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous to become a better channel to carry the message to newcomers. And hopefully, although 19 years and some character defects just do not want to leave, hopefully, as time goes on, God has taken away certain things. Thank God. But, you know, it's funny when you come here and you're young or you're whatever age, you know, on the shade, it says we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. There's another important line in the big book that says that we find objectionable. See, there's a little problem there when I came in. Because most of the things that the rest of the world thinks are objectionable are basically all the things I enjoy. So that's kind of like hard to, how can I be ready to get rid of them or God take them away? They're still on my list of things I love to do. And I've found how God has taught me is that objectionable things, I find out why they're objectionable. They cause immense pain in one's life. They cause immense emotional disturbances. They cause 8-step lists longer than I ever want to generate. The rest of the world, you know, I always talk about my boss when I speak, because when you come here, you're so programmed that it's us and them. There's those of us in recovery and the horrible outside world, the civilians. And I've found that's really not true. There are really some good, decent people out there. Unaided. It bothers me. Unaided. Because I have a boss who has a bad temper. And I always say, you know, what bothers me about his bad temper is that when he loses it, whether it's a couple of hours of the next day, he will walk to my office. He will sit down in the chair in front of my desk. He will close the door for privacy. And he will say, you know, I'm really sorry I lost my temper yesterday. And it kills me. No 10th step the night before. No call to a sponsor. He's just wired that way. Like somewhere he learned that when you're wrong, you say you're sorry. When you've wronged or brought harm to someone, it's almost embarrassing now for me to realize how long it has taken me to learn that. To be automatic. And even more embarrassing, when I go back to my old ways of wanting to justify that someone else caused me to act that way. And I don't owe an amends. And I never want to be perfect enough to convince people that at 19 years sober, making amends is not a regular part of my daily life. I travel all around the world for work. I have a great career. I got to tell you, flying to Newark on a snowy day when my flight has been canceled like 3 times and I haven't eaten for like 9 hours, it's not a pretty sight sometimes, no matter how much I'm reading. I even have the big book downloaded on my Kindle now, and I'm like, you know, and still, as my sponsor told me, you know, you should have breakfast when you get up because you're a much better person to deal with the rest of the world. It has no idea whether you like eating in the morning. You know, it was like being taught to go to the dentist and being taught to go to the doctor. All things that I had no idea that the regular world has been doing that I seem to, like my, when I came here I had no dental insurance. So my plan for dental pain was live through the pain. It eventually goes away for a period of time. And then it comes back really, really bad, but you live through it again, and then it will go away, and then it will come back really, really bad again. That's basically how I was trained to live life, to avoid conflict, unless, you know, violent conflict I have no problem with. But conflict of any kind of nature that's emotional, I avoid. That I'll just pretend is not a problem, and it'll go away. That's basically how I dealt with my entire life. And, you know, coming in at AA, I just want to say, people, places, and things was one of those things I was taught, you know, as a big book thumper. We don't need to worry about that. Well, again, I'm going to go back. Safe and protected through the steps, after the 9-step promises, through the 10-step, that you recoil from alcohol like a flame might be true. But if you're new, and you are not safe and protected, and you barely have a foundation in Alcoholics Anonymous, I know for me, I had no business being around certain people. I always talk about Labor Day weekend, 1984. You know, my drinking is the type where I can't really give a lot of exact stories because I'd be lying because I'm a blackout drinker. I know the times I was arrested because that's public record. So I can piece together certain nights. But Labor Day weekend, 1984, I was on probation. I just graduated high school. My girlfriend asked me if I was going to play in the Labor Day weekend softball, one-pitch softball tournament. And I had played in it for the last 2 years, and I said, no, I can't go there. I finally figured out that I can't stop drinking during softball season at 18 years old. So my plan was I was going to let the spring season go by and count days after the 4th of July. Because for me, when I got in here and I heard, you know, old people, which for me at that time was like 30 and higher, if I heard them saying they were afraid of Thanksgiving, Christmas, and New Year's, well, that's not my story. I'm more a Memorial Day, July 4th, Labor Day kind of guy. Like, those are more my holidays. But so I started counting days after the 4th of July, and when my girlfriend told me, asked me if I was going, and I said, no, I couldn't go, she said, well, I'm going. She said, you know, I got to drive you everywhere. You don't got a license. You got to be home on Saturday mornings because the probation officer comes by to make you take a breathalyzer. All my friends are going to be there, and I'm not going because I'm not going because of you. And so, my pride, my jealousy, all that stuff. I said I'm going. I just won't drink. And so I made it like about 2 minutes in that parking lot. It was a Friday afternoon, about 90 degrees. There's a cooler with tons of Budweiser in it, and it's hotter. And I'm around none of my AA foundation. And I'm unaided by the protection of the steps. So I picked up a beer. And so 3 hours later, I'm in left field. I have a beer on the foul line because I can't possibly walk from left field to the dugout without a beer. You know, I have a cigarette behind my ear. I have chewing tobacco in my mouth. That night, that girlfriend, I blow her off. I'm going out drinking with the boys. I wind up out in the Hamptons. I wind up staying out there. I wind up going to a place called the Bawdy Barn that Sunday afternoon. I wind up getting arrested for disorderly conduct and fighting. And I wind up waking up on Monday morning in a jail in the Hamptons. So people, places, and things, if you're new, is very, very important. I don't want to say it's not. Getting a sponsor and getting a home group, you know, I used to hear all the time, join a group, get a sponsor, and get active. and I used to hear all the time, if you can do five things, wake up in the morning and ask God for help even if you don't believe in Him, go to a meeting, read two pages of AA literature, talk to another alcoholic, and when you go to bed at night, thank God for keeping you sober even if you don't believe. Like, those things were immensely helpful in the beginning to me. And I was in and out of AA a long time. You know, I hear all these things. You know, I always tell, I sponsor a lot of young guys. And I always get the ones who say, you know what, it's definitely drugs in them. I have an NA big book in my house for the fact that when I'm at my backyard kitchen table and some young kid wants to tell me that, you know what, I really pushed the limit with the crystal meth and the crack. I understand that. But I'm pretty sure I can drink. And I just give them that literature to let them know that the bad news is, even if you go to the other fellowship, drinking's not an option for a person like you. And, you know, so I get that. I get the pushback of, well, maybe it was a phase. You know, I don't believe that everyone who comes here is alcoholic. That's not my job. My job is if somebody reaches a hand out for help, put my hand out, and I'm willing to take them through the big book to let them find out if they're an alcoholic, not to let me find out if they're an alcoholic. You know, that's their personal decision. And I have to be spiritually open-minded enough that if they decide they're not an alcoholic, I honor that decision. But, you know, coming in and out of AA a lot, I tell young people all the time to read the big book, because if people are telling you stuff, that's not AA. It's the greatest reason to read the big book. You know, if I had my big book, it's outside of my car right now. It has lots of fancy notes. It has lots of highlights. A different color highlighter for the different time I went through the book. But the highlights and the notes is not the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. Simply my notes or something passed on to me by someone I went through the big book with. The program is the black part of the big book. The part that's written in the print that came with the book. And, you know, so when a young kid tells me that some person at a meeting just told him he can't wear a hat at a meeting, I just say, you should read the big book. You will see that how you dress has nothing to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. You will see that what religion you are, what color you are, whether you like the same sex, opposite sex, both sexes, none of that has anything to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. Whether you have piercings, tattoos, wear a suit and tie, the greatest gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is how inclusive it is, not how exclusive it is. If there's any proof to me of a divinity, if there is a God, it's that a book that was written in 1939 is so open and inclusive at a time when the country had barely come to where we are today. And, you know, I hear things in meetings. You know, like my worst day, how does it go? My worst day sober is better than my best day drinking. That's not my story, for God's sakes. Definitely is not. You know, it's definitely not in the big book. You know, I know the page in the big book. The page in the big book, I believe it's 43, says, I wouldn't trade the life I have today for the life of yesteryear. Well, that's a no-brainer. That's a no-brainer. Today's life, my old life. But don't start comparing days. I'm a drinker's drinker. I've had some great, great times out there. Don't start me making it so that I have to think that my worst day sober has to be better than my best day drinking. Because it has nothing to do with the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I tell people all the time, spring break Fort Lauderdale, 1986, was much better than my first day incarcerated at 6 months sober. Yeah. It just was, you know? It's a fact of my spiritual truth. And, you know, I wound up killing someone drinking and driving, and that doesn't make me an alcoholic either. It comes with a whole host of other circumstances that, you know, AA didn't, you know, AA gives me a way to not pick up a drink a day at a time as a result of the 12 steps. Thank God I had a sponsor who knew that that accident came with some extra baggage. And he wasn't afraid, after I went through the steps, to refer me somewhere outside of AA to help me get through something that has nothing to do with staying away from a drink. And, you know, I get, you know, worried sometimes when I, you know, and I know it happens. People go through the big book, and I was that person who then gets enlightened and feels like my life's on fire, and I'm going to be the savior of the world with this big book. The fact of the matter is I have to check my ego at the door when I sponsor people. And if I think something is a little bit more than a pattern on a fourth step, or a little bit more than a character defect, then maybe I have to be open-minded enough that maybe they need to go to another 12-step fellowship, or maybe they need to get some outside help. But I need to respect the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, that there's outside help out there. I talked about consequences, and I really, consequences never helped a guy like me. I don't believe that accident got me sober. I drank after that accident, and I think I needed to drink after that accident. And that's another thing about newcomers that I notice over the last 19 years, is the newer you are, or the newer I was, the more I needed to drink. Most of the people I meet have things going on in their life that are so horrific, they never needed alcohol as bad as they do now when they're trying to stop drinking. Sometimes it's easy, I think, you get a couple of years. I love the saying, too many years and not enough days. Because you get a few years, and you forget how hard it is to have 11 days. And to have the weight of the world. And you owe everybody, whether it's time in jail, money, whatever it is, to have the weight of the world on your shoulders. I often talk about that I had knee surgery in 1998, I think it was. And I had a second knee surgery. And after the second one, the doctor, he said to me, Billy, you should stop playing ball. And he really was basically saying what a lot of people had told me as a teenager was, you should stop drinking. He basically was saying, you should grow up. You're not 18 years old anymore. But he was nice about it. He just said, you should stop playing ball. And like I told people who told me to stop drinking, I said, you know what? You're right. I should stop playing ball. So when I left his office, I didn't join any league that season. Somebody even came to me like, will you play in the co-ed league? It's very friendly. I said, no, I can't do it. And I was walking to an AA picnic that summer, and I caught out of the corner of my eye a baseball diamond, like a pickup game. Like somebody's hat was at first base, and somebody's shirt was at second base, and like a squished down cardboard from a case of soda was at third base. And the first thing that went through my mind was, the doctor was talking about league. He's not talking about like a pickup game among friends. Now, I laugh about this now because having been in AA a little while, and having played almost anything possible with other alcoholics, basketball, softball, Monopoly, Euchre, Spades, Trivial Pursuit, any kind of video game, I have yet to meet another alcoholic who likes to lose. I meet people like me. I meet people who just love to win. And they're horrible losers and even worse winners. Like, that's me. But I tell myself this, he was talking about league. I can play a friendly pickup game amongst friends. And so I'm playing that friendly game amongst friends, and I'm in left field. And, I don't need to tell you my fourth step tonight. I'm very clear on what a speaker meeting is. It's to bring some hope to the newcomer that I can't be your salvation or your savior. But maybe I'll say one thing that I'll ask you to ask one person here who you'll see again at a meeting this week or next week for their phone number and reach out to them that maybe you think you might possibly be an alcoholic. And before you make the worst decision you could ever make, which is to pick up a drink before you find out whether you are or you aren't, you ask someone to help you find out if you are before you play with that first drink. But if I were to take you into my fourth step a little bit, just a little peek, if you're a guy and you're on it, you're probably good at sports, you're probably good looking, and I don't like you. I always say, I hate to admit how shallow I am, but, that's just, you play the cards you dealt. But there was a guy up at bat, and I didn't like him, and I didn't know him, I'm definitely a guy who can sit in an AA meeting, never seen someone before in my life, But I see him getting coffee, and for whatever reason, I don't like him. Well, I didn't like this guy. He was good, and he was good looking, and so I didn't like him. And he hit a wicked line drive. And anyone who plays baseball would know that you would just catch it on one hop, and you would throw the baseball to second base, and he would stop at first. That's just the way the game is played. And, you know, that night, and this isn't a joke, and I'm not exaggerating, but, you know, I limped back to my car. My knee that I had surgery on was twice the size it usually is. I had split it open. I had dried blood all over my shorts and my socks and my leg. I had to take a Ziploc bag that someone brought hamburgers with to the picnic and stuff it with ice and tape it around my knee. And I was in excruciating pain. And as I was limping back to my car that night, I swear to God, the only thought that ran through this sick mind was, that might have been the best catch I've ever made, you know? Like, that really may have been the greatest catch I've ever made. And all this pain is like secondary, like, which is exactly the way I drink. It doesn't matter the consequences. Because, you know, if you're new, I want to spend the last couple minutes talking about this. I've woken up a lot of mornings. Well, first of all, in sobriety, I've gone to bed a lot of nights thinking I wanted to drink, and I've never woken up one morning wishing I had. And I heard someone else say that, and I've never forgotten it, ever. I've never woken up one day wishing I had drank the night before. I've gone to bed where I thought my whole life was caving down on top of me in sobriety. People ask me, they say, oh, I'm going to have that person sponsor me, and I'll be like, why? And they'll be like, oh, they know the big books are good. I'm like, listen, well, my advice? Find the guy or gal who has had their life completely given back to them by the aid of the steps and then had it taken away. Had their heart ripped out, lost the job they always wanted, had their complete life collapse on them in sobriety, and through the aid of the 12 steps hasn't had to pick up a drink. Like, that's your guy or gal. There's no such thing as the yellow brick road to sobriety. There's no Rose Petals Anonymous that you're just going to walk through this life, you know, like, it's the person day in, day out who has gone through life and not picked up a drink. And, you know, as a new person, I know for me, it was just important that I be surrounded by AA. It was important that I learned that you can't be around AA, you have to be in AA. It was important that I learned sponsor was not a cop, was not a probation officer, was not a social worker, was not a guidance counselor. It's just something you have to have. It was important that I learned I had to have a home group. It's not optional in Alcoholics Anonymous. It was important I learned that, you know, givers stay sober and takers drink. As brutal as that sounds. That I'm a taker by nature. Raised to be a taker. Loved to be a taker. And that there's a very simple spiritual arrangement with my higher power, which is that I need to give 51% of the time. Once I cross over that 50% of the time of taking, I am in horribly dangerous territory. You know, when you start to realize things like, you know, the problems I have in my life today, most of those things are things I prayed for a year ago. You know? You know, all the problems that I could list off to you, at one time or another, probably were on a prayer list of mine. And, you know, I've seen miracles in Alcoholics Anonymous. And the last thing I'm going to say is, you know, I have a brother who's gay. And that brother, I tortured my entire childhood. And I'm not, there's nothing to even joke around about that. Like, I emotionally and physically took away his childhood with the worst intentions in the world. Because he didn't hang out with me and my other brother. Because he didn't go where we went. And his life has always been opposite than mine. I've been a disaster since I left the womb. He, like everything he touched, turned to gold since he left the womb. You know, completely opposite. He had 4 Emmys by the time he was 31, a very successful television producer. And except he has my disease. And the gift of Alcoholics Anonymous is that even before he got sober, even as horrible as, you know, my conduct was, as a result of Alcoholics Anonymous, he became one of my best friends. You know, and I used to go to a meeting when I was new that had a lot of gay people at it, and I wouldn't talk to them. I wouldn't sit at the diner table with them. Like, I was so judgmental, so filled with hate, raised to be a bigot, a sexist, a homophobic, anti-Semitic. The list is so long. And that brother, 2 years ago, called me on July 4th. He was sitting on the ledge of his 10th floor apartment. I had taken him in and out of treatment centers and psychiatric facilities. I had driven him out to Karen one time. And he called because he wanted to say goodbye. He wanted me to pass on his goodbyes to the rest of his siblings. And, you know, I'd love to tell you how tough I am, but I pleaded with him not to do it. And with someone else's cell phone, called the New York City police. And, you know, held him on the phone while I was on the phone with the dispatcher, waiting for the emergency services team to crash through and take him, which they did, and then met him at Bellevue and took him out to Karen again. The miracle is not that I'm some great AA member or some great brother. I'm convinced to date the miracle is that God somehow transformed my life and my family's life, that he was willing to reach out to me. That no matter what the past had happened, we had gotten through that. And it's funny, you know, I was just out with him and my other brother last night in New York City. And, you know, AA has restored my family to health. AA has given my family so much that it's a very small price to pay. You know, it's easy to stay sober and you start collecting things and you start getting a life. And the last thing I say to the newcomer tonight is this, is that you start to think, I need to, there's a couple other things I want to do, but I don't have room. So I got to cut back on something. And the men and women that I, you know, look up to in AA have taught me that my brain is just not wired right. I will have this great life going great and I want to do more stuff. And the first thing my brain tells me is cut back on AA. Cut back on the very thing that gave me this life to begin with. And I have to learn, you know, that there's a treatment center that specializes in treating people with over 20 years. And I have a friend who's a retired FBI agent who goes there a couple of times a year to work with people. And they get big book thumpers. They get service junkies. They get meeting makers. They get spiritual giants. They get everybody. And they all have one thing in common. That something else became their primary purpose. Something else slipped into the number one spot. And then all of a sudden AA was number two. And once AA is number two, it's easy to make it number three. And once it's number three, it's easy to make it number four. And that once something else becomes their primary purpose, the handwriting is on the wall. And so I want to wish everyone really a really great holiday season and New Year, and thanks for having me out. Thanks.
We got one more thing before we close.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Rich, and I'm an alcoholic. What a great place to be. There's a young man in this room that I'd like to recognize this evening. He has become a wonderful asset to this Feet First Speakers group, as well as Alcoholics Anonymous. It's already 1 year today. Pete B.
Okay, the group would like to thank Billy for sharing his experience, strength, and hope.